Former internet entrepreneur Andrew Keen was among the earliest to write about the dangers that the internet poses to our culture and our society. His 2007 book, The Cult of the Amateur, was critical in helping advance the conversation around the internet, which is now morphed from a tool providing efficiencies and opportunities for consumers and business to an elemental force that is profoundly reshaping our societies and our world. In his new book, How to Fix the Future, Keen focuses on what we can do about this seemingly intractable situation, looking to the past to learn how we might change our future. He describes how societies tame the excesses of the Industrial Revolution, which, like its digital counterpart, demolished long-standing models of living, ruined harmonious environments, and altered the business world beyond recognition. There are five key tools that Keen identifies: regulation, competitive innovation, social responsibility, worker and consumer choice, and, of course, education. Andrew Keen is one of the world's best-known and controversial commentators on the digital revolution. He is the author of three previous books. The brand new book is How to Fix the Future, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Andrew Keen to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Such a nice introduction.
I appreciate it. Give me a sense as to, in looking at your work as I've described it, of how then this you came to this point of wanting to look at, okay, now what do we do?
Well, I think the zeitgeist has shifted. As you said, I wrote a book called Cult of the Amateur in 2007, which pointed out many of the problems with the user-generated Web 2.0 movement of Google and Facebook and Twitter and all those companies. At that point, I was in the minority. I was warning about undermining the curation of professional news. I was worried about the narcissistic quality of social media. I was worried about a winner-take-all economy. And at that point, I was in a small minority. But actually, over the last 10 years, the zeitgeist has shifted. More and more people have actually come around to what I was saying and what some others are saying. So I figured there was no point in just repeating myself endlessly, since more and more people agreed with my critique. The challenge now is to fix the problems.
So talk about some of those challenges, the challenges ahead of fixing those problems.
Well, these are some of the biggest problems of our age. They're connected with unemployment. We have a real crisis on the horizon of smart machines, which are replacing us in the labor force. We have the increasing inequality, which is making a tiny group of technologists in Silicon Valley incredibly rich and in many ways decimating the middle class, not just Silicon Valley, Amazon, too, the five most highly capitalized companies in the world now are all West Coast tech companies. We have a cultural crisis, as I said, of fake news, of incivility, of tech addiction. And we have what I call a problematic business model of surveillance capitalism, which companies like Google and Facebook are giving their products to us supposedly for free. But the reality of these big data companies is that we're using these services, the search engines and social media platforms, and they are taking our data and selling that data essentially to advertisers. So they're becoming incredibly wealthy on our data. We've become the product and we're being watched in everything we do, not literally like the Chinese government or something. But at the same time, it's a creepy kind of economy where we're essentially trading our privacy for free online tools and services.
You write about this in the book, and I find it fascinating that when you talk about technological innovation, we can do really cool things. We can do amazing things. We can do all kinds of we're innovating faster than we can even think of what we can do. But you make the point that this is far surpassing the human ability to actually cope with it and figure it out.
Right. Moore's Law is running ahead of us. Moore's Law, Gordon Moore's Law about the doubling of computer chip power every 18 months is meaning that we're losing our agency. So I invent another Moore's Law, one around agency, built off the English writer of Utopia, 16th century writer Thomas More, which suggests that throughout history we've always had this kind of crisis where we've invented new technologies, new ways of thinking that have run ahead of us, that have made us feel disempowered, that makes it seem as if everything is inevitable. So our challenge, a challenge of remaining human in the networked age, is to push back and reinvent the future and fix it. That's what our job is as human beings.
And again, the title of the book is How to Fix the Future. But you talk about, but there's the now too, right? I mean, the realization that there's some things that are very, very broken. And we have to come to that realization too, don't we? I mean, you make the point in the book that these technological changes are the root of the unrest that we're seeing around the world, that everything from Brexit to the election of Donald Trump and elsewhere around the world, that this all can come from this unrest.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to give technology too bad a rap. I think if we blame everything on technology, then we create a situation where we smash technology, where we want to shut these companies down, where we want to punish Silicon Valley. And I think that's not the way to fix the future. What I would say is that the disruption all around us, our sense of powerlessness, our sense of something's changing dramatically in the world, is very much bound up in the digital revolution, from transportation to healthcare, obviously to media, to education. Everything is changing because of technology. But I don't think we can blame technology for that. And I think just as technology has created a lot of problems, it's also created many, many opportunities. And in my book, I travel around the world, from Estonia to Singapore to Germany to Brussels, to the east and west coast of the United States and London. And I show the way in which people are trying to use this technology to improve society rather than just undermine everything.
When you look at what we have done, I'm interested in where you see the successes, where you see where we can go further and extrapolate on ideas that are being used to, quote unquote, fix the future.
I think Estonia is an interesting model. It may not work at the federal level in the U.S., but it does work at the local level. The Estonians are trying to build a new social contract around data between government and citizens based on transparency, where the government will see everything we do, but at the same time, the government will become increasingly transparent itself and accountable in terms of us knowing who and when our data is being examined. The Estonians have also invented a digital ID card and a new kind of business portal, which allow anyone essentially to become an Estonian, or at least allow everyone to use Estonian services. So the Estonia, which most of your listeners, I guess, will know, is a small northeastern Baltic state, the very edge of Europe on the border of Russia, is doing some incredibly interesting things. Singapore as well, in terms of smart nation. I'm a little bit more ambivalent about Singapore's government and their record of democracy, but it's also doing pretty interesting stuff. Their education system is extremely innovative. And the levels of trust in Singapore and Estonia are much higher than in the West. We were promised with the digital revolution that we would have a kind of cornucopia of things, an abundance, that everything now would be infinite. But the reality is we have new scarcities in the digital age. The two, I think, most problematic scarcities being attention. We can't concentrate on anything because everything's, you know, we're being hit on all sides all the time by information. And trust. Trust is another thing which is increasingly scarce. So we need to look at models of government and indeed companies which are actually increasing trust. I think we need more work from Silicon Valley, more accountability. Some of the entrepreneurs of Silicon Valley, some of the billionaires, are doing their best, or at least beginning to do their best in terms of taking responsibility, becoming accountability. But we need more from them.
As I mentioned in the introduction, you identify five key tools: regulation, competitive innovation, social responsibility, worker and consumer choice, and education. Let us begin with regulation. Why is that so important?
Well, it's always been important. I think Americans, maybe particularly on the West Coast, have a real problem with regulation. They think regulation is always against innovation. But I use the example of the Industrial Revolution. In the middle of the 19th century, the Industrial Revolution was pretty much unregulated. You had 11-year-olds working in factories. You had those factories belching the most terrible pollution into towns. You had no regulation of foodstuff or housing. There were no laws in terms of protecting people from unemployment or from disability. And over the last 100 years, there's been all sorts of regulation of the industrial economy, which it mostly has been good for us. We need the same kind of regulation, I think, when it comes to the digital economy. In the late 19th century, it had dominant, monopolistic, exploitative oil companies and railroad companies and finance companies. And then we had the rise of antitrust, which broke some of these companies up, which enabled a fairer playing field and stimulated innovation. We're back in the late 19th century today, in the early part of the 21st century, with these rise of these massive companies. And the Bezoses and the Zuckerbergs are the equivalent of the robber barons of the 19th century. And we need to see people like Andrew Carnegie as being inspiring and the regulatory effort to actually make this technology beneficial for society and not just a tiny group of individuals.
Of course, you also talk about competitive innovation, which we've discussed. I mentioned social responsibility. That seems to me the hard one. I mean, they're all hard, but that one's really hard, isn't it?
Well, it's always hard, but that's the nature of history. Some people are selfish, some people are lazy. But if we care about the future we're leaving to our kids, we need to step up. Now, it doesn't mean becoming Gandhi or Martin Luther King. You know, we're not going to sacrifice our lives. We can do small things. We can demand that our politicians look more carefully at antitrust when it comes to these companies. We can demand, as parents, we can make sure that our children aren't addicted to their devices. So this changes through many small things. Heroic acts are wonderful for movies, but in real life, most of us don't really have the time or the energy for that.
So do you find one of these more challenging than the other, or are they all challenging?
Well, I think the most challenging is education, because it's the most important. It's the one that immediately occurs to us. Well, we've got to change the education system. We've invented these smart machines that are kind of replicating us. So we don't need the old industrial education system, which essentially taught us to think like computers, but we didn't. We weren't competing with computers, so we had some value. I think education offers a profound challenge. My last chapter is on education. I hope some of your listeners will have a chance to read the book. It's an ambitious chapter because it rethinks education. Rather than focusing on learning, on stuffing our heads full of information, I think what our innovative education establishments need to do, like Waldorf schools, which I visit, or Montessori schools, is they need to work on our muscle of agency. They need to bring out what it is to be human. They need to bring out the empathy and the creativity in us, the very things that computers can't do. We're living in the networked digital 21st century. We've invented smart machines, thinking machines, smart algorithms that replicate most of what we do. So our education system needs to focus on the very things that those smart machines can't do. Otherwise, we will indeed become redundant. Otherwise, this great invention may indeed, as some people have suggested, be our last invention.
The name of the book is How to Fix the Future. It is published by Atlantic Monthly Press, and it's a great pleasure to have Andrew Keen on the program this morning. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. That was fun.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book, How to Fix the Future. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.